The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Harris Serrano, captain of the armed civilian yacht Sweet Delight, has successfully defended the agricultural world Xavier from an attack by raiders. Now, a fleet battle group, led by Commodore Deccan Garavay, has arrived to assist in the defense. But Harris has suspicions about the Commodore.
You think he's turned?
We have to stop them.
If you're wrong about any of it,
then I'm dead.
Ah, Captain. Or may I call you Harris? What was it you wanted to talk to me about?
Well, Commodore.
Attention, all personnel. This is Commander Harris Serrano, now acting captain of this vessel.
There's something jumping in.
Engage.
Meanwhile, on the planet Patchcock, Ronnie, George, and Rafaela are on a secret mission to investigate the murder of the daughter of a wealthy family.
So you think Otala knew something she wasn't supposed to know?
You need to mind your own business.
You killed Otala?
No, you don't.
Is he dead? What about the weapon?
Drop that weapon! Get on the floor! Move!
You won't believe this. They're under arrest for murder and attempted sexual assault.
Serrano Legacy, Book 3, Winning Colors, Part 2. From Graphic Audio.
Concentrate. Concentrate. And visualize a storm.
Graphic Audio presents...
What? What is this storm?
DC Comics.
This is a code A emergency. Do you copy?
Justice League of America. Superman. The never-ending battle.
There is power that not even they can overcome. Where is he?
I have my own reserves, fool!
Hello, Superman. If you can still hear this, you are in the final moments of your life.
Copyright 2008, DC Comics. Justice League of America, Superman, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics 2008. All rights reserved.
And now, our feature presentation. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Acil Ford, Dolores King Williams, Colleen Delaney, Mort Shelby, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Johan Detweiler, Thomas Penny, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Eric Messner, M.B. Van Dorn, Stephen Carpenter, Michael Glenn, and Kate Torrey. Deathlands number 82, Apocalypse Unborn.
Temperature of specimen 24-B95.7 degrees Fahrenheit and rising. All systems functional. Temperature of specimen 24-B97.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Starting stage 5. Temperature of specimen 24-B98.7 degrees Fahrenheit, resuming normal life operations. Nervous system and respiratory functions are satisfactory. Activating musculoskeletal system.
Colonel Graydon Bell's naked body was sent into convulsions. Through sleep-dimmed wits, he tore away the tangle of electrical leads at the base of his skull.
Where am I? Why can't I see?
Hello, specimen 24-B. I understand your concern and inability to see normally. Please remove the pliable adhesive from your eyes now.
An adhesive?
Protective material removed from his brow and cheeks, Bell cautiously raised one eyelid.
I understand your concern. Your optic nerves have been long dormant. Please take your time in acclimating them to light.
Through streaming tears, Bell could see the cryotank's vacuum lid had opened. A bank of fluorescent bulbs burnt patterns in his eyes.
You are being fed oxygen through an intubation hose. Please remove it from your nasal cavity to allow your lungs to function on their own.
Okay. My mouth tastes like I've been chugging maple syrup.
I understand your concern. Prior to cryogenic preservation, your tissues were infused with a naturally occurring antifreeze known as Trehalose.
Trehalose? It keeps the water in my body from crystallizing and breaking my cell walls.
Correct. Welcome back, Colonel Graydon Bell. If you need any assistance, please ask.
Bracing his arms and back against the wall, Bell used his legs to slowly straighten them, fighting the cramps that seized his thighs and buttocks. When he looked down at his corpse-white body, he saw wasted muscles, every rib showing, tendons standing out like load-maxed cables. Red starbursts of exploded capillaries dotted his skin, galaxies of them.
Freezer burn.
The first stirrings of memory returned. The jumble of terrifying images and sensations sent Bell's heart racing. The cryotank on the other side of the room hadn't opened yet. Rivulets of condensation peeled down the module's gleaming sides, and a small red light blinked politely. Reanimation in progress. From where Bell lay, he could read the tank's LED indicators. The internal temperature was 89.9 degrees Fahrenheit and rising. Heart restart was still 14 minutes, 16 seconds away, a delay due to the fact that there was more of Dr. Antoine Kirby to thaw. 52 pounds more, to be exact. Still dazed, Colonel Bell dragged himself out of the cryotank, his muscles responding with stiff jerks. Finally, with much effort, he stepped out onto the lab floor. Bell was seized by a stabbing pain in his gut. Expelled trehalose syrup drew a 10-foot-long stripe on the polished concrete. His stomach knotted, and blood mixed with bile dripped from his chin. The cryolab's computer control consoles were 20 feet away. Unable to stand, he crawled hand over hand until he reached the nearest desktop, then hauled himself into an ergonomic chair. On the counter before him were framed photos, color portraits of two beaming families, both of them his. Five children, ages 6 to 16, produced by two marriages. The boys and girls had inherited their father's firm chin, wide-set brown eyes, and extraordinary intelligence. They were the joy of his life, the wellspring of his inspiration. When Bell looked up at the mission chronometer, the atomic clock that measured elapsed time to hundredths of a second, an icy hand pushed into the center of his chest and gripped his heart. Chronologically, Graydon Bell was 135 years old. Everyone he had ever loved was dust. And they had died unaware of his desperate all-or-nothing sacrifice to save them. Bell had thrown himself upon the anvil of death, anonymously, selflessly, unsure of resurrection, but confident that the threat facing all of humanity required nothing less.
In the world of pure science, in Bell's world, confidence was a mathematical construct, a numeric of probability that separated fact from speculation. By the first week of January 2001, he and Dr. Kirby were 95% certain that a disintegration of global defense systems was imminent, a cascade of incremental failures leading inexorably to Armageddon, an all-out nuclear missile exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. Their elaborate and ingenious computer models had revealed the near future, and it was a dead end. But their warnings had fallen on deaf ears. Things might have been different if they'd had some kind of quick, cheap fix to offer the directors of the ultra-secret Operation Kronos, which was responsible for the first successful experiments in time travel. Kirby and Bell's research on the structure of supra-time space had started out as theoretical and abstract, but had soon become vital to the Black Budget program's main thrust. Time trawling had mind-bending military and economic potential. It opened the possibility of effective social engineering on a global scale, the permanent rewriting of history in favor of those who controlled the technology. For any number of practical reasons, it was easy to dismiss Kirby and Bell's conclusions out of hand. The idea that Operation Kronos had already accidentally triggered a chain reaction at the most fundamental level of reality was nothing short of heresy. As Bell struggled with numb fingers to log on to the redoubt's computer, logic told him that what he and Kirby feared most had come to pass. Otherwise, they would have been discovered and reanimated by their Kronos colleagues a century ago.
Hello! Hello! This is Colonel Graydon Bell of Operation Kronos. Does anybody read me? This is Colonel Bell of the United States Army. Come in, anybody! Computer, when was the last transmission?
I understand your concern. Last transmission sent at. Not found.
Not found? Are the satellites still running?
Pinging satellite. No response. Pinging backup satellite. No response.
They must have fallen out of orbit or been fried by an EM burst. Can you check for radioactivity on the surface?
Background radiation is 4 times higher than normal. Ambient temperature is 89 degrees Fahrenheit.
89 degrees? But it's winter.
Current ambient temperature is in line with 50-year historical averages.
Oh, God.
There was no way around the evidence. Buried deep in a mountainside in a nuke-hardened site, he had survived Armageddon. There was no satisfaction in having been proved right. Bell sat back in the chair, overwhelmed by grief and guilt. He and Dr. Kirby were at least partially responsible for the destruction of civilization, and for millions, perhaps billions of deaths, including those of his own children. In the beginning, their interest had been as selfish and blind as the would-be land grabbers and slave masters. Supra-time space was a mathematical perspective outside the biologically hardwired human experience of time. Kirby and Bell wanted to be the first scientists to map this new overarching dimension, and the only way to do that was to evaluate and interpret the results of successful time-trolling experiments. Had their ongoing research, codenamed Project Undo, not been critical to the director's goal of controlled manipulation of the time stream, it would never have been so lavishly funded. Analyses of the handful of Operation Kronos triumphs had revealed few facts about the boundaries of supra-time space, and even less about its apparent congruencies and paradoxes, but had convinced Kirby and Bell that time trawling, in and of itself, could disrupt present reality in unforeseen and ultimately catastrophic ways. With no support from their superiors, the researchers faced the most difficult of moral and professional choices. They could either sit back and watch the inevitable, dying alongside their family and friends, or they could attempt to do something to change the outcome, which meant abandoning the still intact present to its terrible fate. In the end, they decided they had to act. No one alive knew more about the implications of temporal alteration than they did. For that reason, they had used cryogenics instead of time trawling to reach the future. Graydon Bell was a physicist, not a medical doctor, but he understood as well as anyone the physiological aftermath of cryogenesis. Over time, despite all the precautions, minerals leached from bone and tissue, and neurochemicals in the brain degraded. He had anticipated some cell loss upon reanimation, some memory loss, maybe even the temporary loss of sanity. There was no way to anticipate the impact of a temporal disruption on the subatomics of a frozen human body. He and his still-thawing research partner had taken the fateful leap forward, fully aware of their ignorance and vulnerabilities. At 6'3", Antoine Kirby had been an All-America defensive end for the University of California at Berkeley football team. Cat quick, NFL quick, but way too smart for pro sports. The mathematical genius had dropped football after he'd completed his athletic contract. It was merely a means to an end, a free undergraduate education. The money he saved helped finance a PhD from Princeton. When Operation Kronos had recruited him, he was back in the Bay Area, working at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. Always smiling, always happy, thrilled by the potential of his research, Kirby was unmarried, with many close friends, but no living family. While Kirby was away at Princeton, Bell was serving in Columbia, a U.S. Army-financed doctorate in physics from Caltech under his belt. His mission had been to lead a covert combat field test of a new generation of shoulder-fired laser-burst weapons on FARC narco-terrorists. Of the two, only Bell had taken human life. Success in Columbia had brought him quick advancements to the Army's most theoretical and problematic programs, and ultimately a dream assignment. Operation Kronos' directors had paired a world-class physicist with a world-class mathematician and turned them loose to explore the fringes of the known and the possible. Bell surveyed the room. Racked along one wall of the lab, in hermetically sealed plastic cases coated with protective grease, were a variety of conventional combustion-fired weapons. M16 assault rifles, some equipped with over-under grenade launchers, 12-gauge SPAS assault shotguns, 9mm Beretta semi-automatic pistols, extra magazines, ammo canisters. Body armor and night vision goggles had their own cases, as did the M60, 308 caliber machine guns, and the heavy-barreled bolt-action night-scoped Remington sniper rifles. Purely rational scientific exploration had devolved to this. Bell switched screens to monitor the LED countdown to heart restart. As the final seconds ticked away, he prayed for Kirby's successful reanimation. He prayed that he would not have to face the coming trials alone.
Temperature of specimen 24-A, 97.7, starting stage 5. Hydraulics error on tank 4. Human response required.
Kirby! Kirby! Are you okay?
Get me out of here! Get me out of here! Let me out!
Hang on! I'll get you out! Just relax!
As Colonel Bell inspected the busted hydraulics, a wave of profound relief swept over his body. He wasn't in the hunt by himself, after all. Once he got Kirby out, they could undo the nuclear holocaust. They believed they could reverse the erasure of human history. Whether they had sacrificed themselves for nothing, only time would tell. Earth was vast, and remade primeval by the fires of hell. To locate, capture, and retrieve one man could take decades. The one man who was the locus of Armageddon, the seed of destruction, the dropped stitch. For the world to right itself, Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner had to die when and where he was supposed to die.
What god are you sluts from?
The man standing in line behind Dr. Mildred Wyatt smelled like pan-fried shit, the cologne of a mass grave robber or a muti skinner. He was leaning so close to her that she could feel his breath between the beaded plaits of her hair on the base of her neck. Mildred didn't turn. She had already sized him up. A large sheath knife rode in a scabbard on his hip. A Remington 12-gauge autoloader hung from a worn leather shoulder sling. Both barrel and buttstock had been crudely sawn off, the former at the end of the tubular magazine, the latter behind the black tape-wrapped pistol grip. He was tall and lean, between 20 and 30 years of age, with a weather-seamed, dirt-encrusted face. His pupils were dilated, his sandy brown mustache and whiskers blackened by a tarry substance, which he recognized as the residue from smoking, powdered mindburst mushroom. According to its devotees, it made live skinning and grave robbing even more fun. Christy Roth faced Mildred, but she was looking beyond her, over her shoulder at the skinner. Although Christy's eyes were emotionless pools of emerald green, her forehead smooth as glass, her red mutant hair had coiled into tight ringlets of alarm. A chill, steady mist fell from the low-hanging fog bank. Tiny, sparkling droplets clung to the tips of Christy's prehensile curls and the shaggy black fur of her bearskin coat, which hung open from collar to hem.
Hey, didn't we take turns banging you two over in Byronville?
Yeah, I think we did. That was fun, wasn't it?
Mildred ignored that question, too. The second man was shorter, bare-chested, stump-legged, just as filthy as his running buddy, and wearing the same black sticky ring and the whiskers around his mouth. Tucked into the front of his trouser waistband was a battered 9mm Astra semi-auto. Mildred pursed her lips. The idea was to blend in with the rest of the ragged queue on the pre-dark pier. A light onshore breeze riffled the surface of Morrow Bay. The massive 570-foot-tall rock that marked the entrance from the Pacific Ocean played peekaboo in the gray swirls of fog. Heavy surf broke over the bay's 3-mile arch of sandspit. The rise in sea level after the nuclear holocaust put the spit underwater at high tide and submerged the walkway and side railings of the concrete pier. The tide was out now, and the pier, much foreshortened by wave damage to its seaward end, was high and dry. Here and there along the mucky crescent of Morrow Bay's exposed shoreline, amid the tangled metal and plastic refuse, lay stripped human skeletons and lumps of mud and wet cloth in human shape. In the bay, some 150 yards to the north, a 3-masted white ship swung at anchor. It couldn't tie up to what was left of the pier. The water was too shallow. Prospective passengers and cargo waited on the dock to be ferried to the frigate. At the ruined end of the pier, a makeshift crane lowered crates and boxes onto rowboats. Beside the crane, a rickety stairway led down to a floating platform and a tethered boat. The entrance to the stairs was guarded by 4 thickly built crewmen with assault rifles. Before passengers were allowed to descend, they were interrogated by a man seated behind a plank and sawhorse table who entered information into a logbook. The line moved forward, very slowly. Mildred remembered the last time she'd passed through Morrow Bay, more than a century earlier, and a year and a half before the end of the world. In the terminology of Deathlands, Dr. Wyeth was a freezy. On December 28th, 2000, an idiosyncratic reaction to anesthetic during abdominal surgery had put her into a coma. In a last-ditch effort to save her life, the operating team had placed her in cryogenic stasis, where she remained until revived by Ryan Cotter, Christy Roth, and their companions. Mildred and her liberators had been inseparable ever since. If the picturesque Central California coastal town was far enough away from San Francisco and Los Angeles to avoid a stray missile hit on Hell Day, it hadn't escaped the nuclear shock and tidal waves produced by saturation, hydrogen, and Earthshaker warhead strikes both north and south. Most of Morrow Bay's existing structures had been obliterated in the furious aftermath of Armageddon, yet it had hung on and survived as a human outpost, as the southernmost seaport on Deathland's Pacific coast. What was left of the Los Angeles-San Diego megalopolis was anybody's guess. It was widely rumored that the lower half of California had vanished into the Pacific Ocean, vaporized by overlaid nuclear hits or submerged by cataclysmic slippage along the full length of the San Andreas Fault. Reports about what remained were both sketchy and far-fetched. Mildred had never met anybody who claimed to have seen it with their own eyes, only those who had heard about it, third or fourth hand. It was not the kind of place visitors returned from. Most Deathlanders she'd met believed that normal life couldn't exist there, that the air and water were poisoned by high radiation levels and reawakened volcanic processes. Moreover, they were convinced that it was the fountainhead of every manifest evil, the spawning ground of new species of predatory mutants, monsters that spread forth across the ravaged continent like carnivorous weeds. As a 20th century scientist, Mildred was dubious of all this speculation. For one thing, the concepts of norm and muti were relative, not either or. Every living thing in Deathlands had been impacted at a genetic level by the Holocaust. Some of these changes were manifested externally, most were not. That a particularly heavily nuked area could generate a high rate of successful mutations did not jibe with pre-apocalyptic genetic research, which showed that the higher the rad dose, the more negative the mutations. The affected embryos rarely made it past the early stages of development. If Southern California was indeed the source of the plague of unheard-of hostile species, Mildred suspected that something much more complicated, much more directed, had to be going on. One way or another, she and Christy and the others waiting on the pier were about to discover the truth. Post-Newcost Morrow Bay had been rebuilt using recycled materials from the former marina and from the fleet of commercial fishing boats and private yachts scattered high onto the hillsides by tidal waves and hurricane-force winds. Single-story, ramshackle shacks shared walls and pre-dark concrete block and slab foundations. There was not a single right angle in the entire ville. Nor was there much in the way of ground cover, save for the clumps of tiny wild daisies sprouting along the open trench latrines. It reminded Mildred of movies she'd seen of Calcutta, India, a seething, mounded garbage dump shrouded by acrid wood smoke. Ville folk furtively watched the line of newcomers from window holes punched in their cardboard walls. Concealed in shadow, they huddled in entranceways. Though Morro Bay serviced the small ship trade to coastal outposts in the north, it had no gaudy as such. That sort of business was conducted in the earthen ditches alongside the road. There were no frantic sluts pandering along the crowded pier this day. No begging children either. Murder for profit was a growth industry here, yet the inhabitants were taking pains to hide themselves. With good reason. The folk who lined the dock were the foulest, most dangerous scum in all of Deathlands. Maniac mercies, double-crossing ex-sec men, slavers, jolt traders, muti hunters, blackheart robbers and killers. The line of human refuse stretched past the end of the pier and wound back up the hill. Most of the cargo crates in the queue held living creatures. The air holes were too small and too widely spaced for Mildred to see what or who was trapped inside.
Hey, slut, I'm asking you a question.
The man shoved Mildred. She took the push smoothly, turning around when she recovered her balance. She saw animal lust, greed, and seamless ignorance. Christy and Mildred were on their own. To avoid being recognized, the six companions had split up at the Ville city limits. Ryan Carter was far ahead of them in line, and the others, Doc Tanner, Jack Lauren, and JB, were spread out some distance behind. Although it was vital to draw no extra attention to themselves, there was another equally important consideration. The voyage south was going to be long and in tight quarters. Unless Christy and Mildred made a statement that could not be misconstrued, they were going to be subject to the unwanted, non-stop, below-decks attentions of 100-odd semi-human shitballs.
Back off.
Maybe you do so much business on your backs you can't remember faces. Do you remember this?
Let's bang him again, right here.
The shorter man moved his hand toward the butt of his remade pistol.
Yeah, we're gonna have us a real good...
Show's over, folks. Just a bunch of dumb shits getting what they deserve.
I'll get the short one, Mildred.
Well, why you got to be stupid and heavy? There we go. Peace and a bit more breathing room.
As Mildred stepped away from the railing, she glanced down the line to the ruined end of the pier. Ryan Carter was now three back from the interrogation table. From a distance of 15 feet, Ryan observed the frigate's captain, a mountain of brown skin and black tattoos, seated behind a makeshift desk. Naked to the waist, his torso and arms were decorated with intertwined thorny vines. His front teeth, top and bottom, were filed to triangular, shark-like points. But most striking was the gruesome facial branding. Four parallel ridges of pink scar tissue ran over the bridge of his wide nose and down his broad cheeks. The corners of his mouth had been likewise disfigured. They twisted upward in a perpetual, manic grin. Ryan recognized the islander blood, what more than a century ago would have been called Maori or Fijian. The captain's black hair hung in a braid down past the middle of his back. He had gold rings on every thick finger and both thumbs. A government model 1911 Colt pistol with an extended high-capacity magazine lay on the tabletop. The .45's hammer was locked back, the grip safety permanently held down with tight wraps of waxed cord. Next to his hand, it looked like a child's toy. The armed, half-naked men on the stairway were islanders, too. They held their AK-47s casually aimed at the next man in line. Safeties off, firing lanes clear. Index fingers braced against the outside of trigger guards. The three mercies standing in front of Ryan wore grease-stained canvas dusters and scarred lace-up boots. They carried well-oiled 9mm Heckler & Koch machine pistols on shoulder slings. The weapons looked to be in excellent condition. They kept their hands in view and well away from their weapons. The first guy in line, presumably the trio's boss, sported a broad-brimmed leather hat pulled down low over his eyes.
Next! Where are you boys from?
We come from Seattle country, over near Fayette. Bastard long war.
Who's your crew for?
crewed for ourselves. We've been wolfpacking for the last 6-8 months.
Wolfpacking, huh? Get anything good?
You know, the usual. Took a few weapons, some furs, and a few goddess slabs.
I see. Anything you got that might help us on our way?
We'll have to see, now won't we?
That we will. I heard there's lots of cannies roaming the bayous these days.
Eh, no more than any place else.
We had a few man-eaters slip aboard the last trip. I guess they thought it was going to be a floating picnic. It wasn't. Bystanders got caught in the crossfire. Hell of a mess.
The captain put a yellow plastic bucket on the table.
You mind spitting in this?
The Mercy leader didn't look back at his pals. He didn't take his eyes off the 4 AK-47s pointed at the center of his chest.
You want some spit? I'll give you spit. That good enough for you, Cappy?
That's just fine.
Hey, why you do my spit?
This here's my secret. See how the stuff's all red? I'll just let it mix a bit and then... see if it turns a color.
The liquid was no longer ruby red. It wasn't even pale pink. It was the color of pre-dark concrete.
Oh, gray means oozies. But you already knew that.
Wait a minute, they don't always...
The Mercy landed flat on his back. A smoldering, gory crater blown from hip to hip. The awful swath of destruction was the product of a muzzleloader packed with metal scrap and bent nails. The other two Mercies jumped through the smoke for the railing. Before the Islander crew could open fire, they dived headfirst over it. The Islanders fired over the rail, full auto. The passenger wannabes rushed to that side of the pier, hot-shotting at the pale shapes swimming toward shore 4 feet under the surface. Brian drew his handgun but didn't join the fray. There was no need. Concentrated bullet impacts churned the water to a fine froth.
Next!
Ryan turned to see the mortally wounded Kenny. The double scattergun blast had gutted him, but missed his heart and lungs. Ryan crouched upwind, just beyond the Kenny's reach, and raised his Sig Sauer.
Hey, you! What the hell?
Ryan turned to the captain and stared at the man's heavily scarred forearms. This was no decorative disfigurement. The oval-shaped, long-heeled wounds were 3.5 inches across. He had lost great divots of flesh, clear down to the bone. Bite marks.
Why'd you waste a good centerfire bullet on that Kenny? He was gonna be dead meat in 5 minutes, tops.
Ryan would have shot a rabid sticky in that condition. But around this company, it was best not to look soft.
Had a clear shot at the bastard. Wanted to get in my licks while I could.
You solo?
Always.
Mercy?
Sec man. Came up under Baron Sepp.
Down Florida way?
Yep. Green Glades.
Old Zip got himself chilled, you know.
He was still breathing when I moved west.
Why'd you leave?
Needed a change of climate.
Lots of people do. Especially for what we're promising. You any good with that long blaster over your shoulder?
Good enough to keep it.
Not good enough to keep your eye.
One's all I need.
Yeah. Spit in the bucket. Check for Uzis. You know what Uzis is, right?
Sure. Canny plague. You get it by eating human flesh. Can't really tell somebody's got it by looking at them until the end, when they start leaking gray pus from their ears and nostrils.
Yep. So you'd best hope this turns out red. Yep, red it is. Call me Captain, or Captain A. Here's your token. Your number's 46. From now on, you are called 46. Wear that tag around your neck at all times. Don't lose it. Without it, you won't be fed or paid. Go down a gangway and wait on a dock. You'll be told what to do. Make no trouble, and you'll have no trouble.
Ryan nodded, although trouble was exactly what he had in mind. He and his friends had missed the chance to chill Magus before. Magus. Steel Eyes. The thing that wouldn't die. Once he had been 100% flesh and blood human. How long ago that was, or where he had come from, was not known. As his organic parts, limbs, organs, sensory arrays, failed due to age or damage, he had used inorganics such as nanotech circuit boards, memory chips, servos, pumps, and titanium struts to make the necessary repairs to himself. The melding of mechanical and biomechanical subsystems had prolonged Magus's life, but the result was not a pretty sight. blood, machine oil, and pus seeped from the joints of angry flesh to gleaming metal, and he was enveloped in the rank odor of his own putrefaction. Over the years, Ryan and his companions had crossed the creature's path more than once, witnessing the unspeakable cruelties he wrought on the innocent and unwary. Ever the puppet master, Magus relied on Norm and Mutie minions to do his wet work and to cover his retreat into the shadows. Steel Eyes had long ago cut out his own humanity. If he still had a heart, that organ was made of plastic and Kevlar. Animated by a seemingly bottomless evil, this reeking, lurching contraption terrified and awed even Deathland's most degenerate human trash. He attracted lesser villains, like moths to a black flame. In the past, Magus had toyed with randomly selected living game pieces, amusing himself by sowing localized horror, apparently on a whim. Attacks on remote, poorly defended vills required relatively small hit crews, which could be assembled from the front porch of almost any gaudy in the hellscape. His slavery and natural resource extraction operations used the same breed of enforcers. Magus was never out of pocket for any of his criminal enterprises. Slave laborers worked for free, and mass murderers were paid in the spoils of carnage. Something new and infinitely more menacing had drawn Ryan and the others halfway across Deathlands to the pier on Morrow Bay. In the last month or so, groups of drifters, traders, and refugees had passed the word along the network of eroded pre-dark interstates, through roadside and dry river bottom campsites, shantyvilles, skeletonized major cities, from gaudy to gaudy, all the way to the eastern baronies. Steel Eyes was recruiting an army of Blackhearts. The call had been sent across the whole of the hellscape. Those who signed on were guaranteed Jack, Jolt, and Joy Juice in unlimited quantities, and the opportunity to indulge in savagery unheard of since Nuke Day. Magus had never shown any ambition for conquest before. He had been content to play on the margins of Deathland's disjointed feudal system, squabbling baronies separated by vast, lawless territories. He seemed as interested in concealing his whereabouts, his motives, and the true extent of his power as he was in wreaking havoc on the defenseless. Until now, the location of his home base was anybody's guess. That it would be in the West Coast's most nuked-out zone, and a place no one would dare look, made perfect sense. If they missed the chance to kill him this time, all of Deathlands would pay the price.
Pull!
Doc Tanner leaned hard against his oar, putting every ounce of his skinny 6'3" frame into the effort. He sat on the right half of the 18-foot boat's middle thwart, facing the stern and the hulking brown-skinned man at the tiller, a man with heavy brows and squinty, slitted eyes. A wispy black chin beard hung down his chest between pendulous, bare breasts. Intricate blue-black tattooing, like a filigreed cape, shadowed sloping shoulders. A remade AK-47 with a steel skeleton stock lay across the tops of the man's thighs. An extra 30-round magazine was taped upside down to the weapon's clip. In the edge of the wooden seat beside him, he had stuck a machete, blade first, its handle within easy reach. A plastic bailing can floated in the bilge water between his bare feet. The boat made smooth, gliding progress toward the anchored frigate. As Doc dipped his oar, he recalled a more pleasant sea voyage, roughly 2 centuries ago. It, too, had been a journey via sailing ship. There had been no rowing required. He had been returning home to the United States from Oxford University in England, where he had earned a PhD degree in science. Shortly after his repatriation, he had met and married the lovely Emily Chandler. Their union had been blessed with 2 children, a girl, Rachel, born in 1893, and a son, Julian, born in 1895. The Tanners began a happy domestic life in Omaha, Nebraska. Their joy was cut short by an unimaginable turn of events. A world stood on its head in a single terrible instant. One afternoon in November of 1896, blind fate had torn Dr. Theophilus Tanner from the bosom of his young family. Blind fate and human cruelty. Out for a stroll with his wife and children, he had been time-trawled against his will by the whitecoats of Operation Kronos, vacuumed up and drawn forward to the year 1998. After almost 2 years of close confinement, constant interrogation, physical and psychological testing, of torture in the name of a twisted, morally bankrupt science, he had been hurled forward in time again, farther still from those he had loved. In a strange and terrible world, he had been adopted by a new family, a family of brothers and sisters of battle, fighters bound together by a common thread, survival. As the boat drew away from the pier, Doc thought he saw Jack Lauren's shoulder-length white hair gleaming among the milling crowd. Jack was a red-eyed albino, a wild child of Deathlands, skilled with leaf-bladed throwing knives and his Colt Python handgun, a young man of few words and great, selfless bravery. J.B., also known as John Barrymore Dix, was farther back in the throng, his fedora hat lost behind much taller heads. J.B. brought up the companion's rear with a 12-gauge Smith & Wesson M4000 pump shotgun. The rest of Doc's extended family, Ryan, Christy, and Mildred, were already on board the white ship. Doc took in the other rowers around him. A motley crew, to be sure. Some had used strips of black plastic bags and winds of duct tape to repair tears in their boots, jackets, and trousers. Their center fire and black powder weapons were mostly well-worn, missing handgun grips replaced with layers of silver tape. Their knuckles were scarred and their faces grimy and gap-toothed. Even the steady headwind couldn't blow away the smell of unwashed funk, spilled joy juice, and the stink of intense fear. None could predict what they might encounter on the road to promised riches, or if, in fact, any riches lay ahead. They kept rowing, though, heads down, backs bent. These were men accustomed to big risk and small rewards. Alone in a small boat in such company, Doc felt considerable unease himself. His ebony sword stick leaned against the thwart, its silver lion's head handle pressing into the side of one of his tall, cracked leather boots. Under his black frock coat hung a massive, holstered black powder pistol. The Lama represented a high point in Civil War weapons technology, two sidearms in one. A 63-caliber single-shot scattergun barrel was married to a 9-shot, 44-caliber revolver. Properly angled from the rowboat's bow, the Lama's blue whistler barrel could incapacitate the entire crew and tillerman in one horrendous stem-to-stern blast. Despite the undeniable appeal of that course of action, Doc put it out of his mind. When it came to evil creatures, these were minnows. The man rowing on the thwart in front of him had four sections of black PVC pipe strapped to his back. Connected in a crude rope frame, the pipes were 2 feet long, 4 inches in diameter, and securely capped at both ends. Air holes had been drilled along the sides every few inches. Leaning over the gunwale a little, Doc managed to catch sight of the side of his face. It was painted a flat white from forehead to neck, ear to ear. Looking more closely at the plastic pipes, Doc saw clustered yellowish feet sticking through the air holes. Crisp, hairy, insect feet.
For lack of a proper name, we call them skagworms.
Doc turned towards the black man rowing beside him. He was the same height as Doc, but the dreadlocks gathered on top of his head, sprouting up like jutting leaves of a great pineapple, gave him another 18 inches. He had a hugely muscled back and corded neck. He, too, wore a rack of PVC pipes.
Skagworms, I said. That's what we call them.
My apologies. Pray tell, precisely how many creatures am I looking at?
One organism per two.
I am unfamiliar with the species.
So is everyone else. That's why they're worth large jack.
Doc turned to the face-painted man. A grizzled short beard stuck through the crusted pigment. Where the paint had flaked off, Tanner could see tiny scattered whorls of red. It appeared the man had taken a load of birdshot full in the face.
All we know about skagworms, we learned the hard way. The armored, bullet-headed, venomous, ill-tempered, oversized mutant millipedes. When we keep their head down in the dark, it puts them right to sleep. They don't seem to need food or water, just air.
Inversion and light deprivation induces a state of hibernation.
Logic would so indicate.
The old man turned to stare at his seatmate. Logic, or even a pretense to same, rarely showed its face among a crowd like this. The black man wore a big, friendly smile, which also seemed a bit odd. The man in whiteface gave a conspiratorial wink.
That isn't the only reason we carry them butt up. Ugly mothers shit all over the place when they're the other way around.
Are they fully grown?
Nah. We're pretty sure these are just babies. We found an unattended nest south of Phoenix. Snatched up a few before Mama Worm got back.
How large do they get?
We didn't stick around to find out. The entrance to the nest was nearly 3 feet in diameter.
Tanner noted that both men wore desert camo BDU pants, rimed with dirt, and patched at the knees with duct tape. Their weapons, M16-1A rifles and military-issue Beretta handguns, were of the same vintage and fine condition, which was unusual. In Deathlands, armament was almost always catch-as-catch-can, a jumble of calibers and gun types. They had either stumbled onto a well-stocked redoubt, or they had traded away something very valuable.
You two are muti hunters?
Yep.
Of all the black heart professions in the hellscape, muti hunter was one of the most profitable and the most loathsome. It involved supplying freaks to fill Baron's muti zoos and Deathlands traveling carnies. The collection process required kidnapping not just the clearly inhuman, like skagworm larvae, but the nearly human. The scaled, the dwarfed, the misshapen. Beings that could think and talk and love. If the unlucky parents objected to losing their children, they were beaten senseless or killed. Generally speaking, muti hunters targeted the very young because they were more easily controlled and transported. That meant the victims would spend their entire lives behind bars.
We were in the middle of selling our worms to a zoo master when we heard about the bounty being paid for extra freaky freaks.
To what end?
Don't know. We changed our plans in a hurry, though.
For all we care, Magus can roast them over a charcoal grill. Long as we get our jack.
You didn't have to leave shore to do that. You could have sold the worms on the dock.
For less than half of what they're worth. Besides, we want to find out what Steel Eyes has got going on down south. Figure it would be a gold mine for enterprising types like us. What about you? You got a specialty?
I'm just a mercy. In search of some new scenery and paying work.
Well, then better keep your eyes open, Mercy, and your blaster in reach.
The rowboat approached the moored ship. The frigate was more than 150 feet long. It had three masts, and the main mast was at least 80 feet tall. Its riveted iron hull had been painted and repainted in thick layers of white. Rust streaks ran from the scuppers down the sides, like bloodstains. As they rounded the ship, they could read the name emblazoned on its battered stern.
Taniwa Tea? What kind of tea is that?
Not tea, you fool. Tia. Tanawa Tia. And she's my mother.
It's in the Maori language. It means white monster.
J.B. Dix climbed the rope ladder to the ship's gangway. He was one of the last of the prospective passengers to get a boarding token. The people left behind on the pier were making a loud fuss, but they kept their weapons holstered and slung. Before the captain had taken his leave, he had warned the crowd that if anyone opened fire on the departing rowboats, the ship's 4-inch guns would broadside them with grapeshot. If the left behind still wanted passage south, they were going to have to wait for the ship's return, a round trip of 7 days or more, depending on sea conditions. J.B. grimaced, thinking about the already cowering citizens of Morrow Bay. They had an unpleasant week ahead. Like the ship's hull, its main deck was made of riveted iron plates, canted on either side of the midline, this to speed seawater runoff into the scuppers. A gauntlet of Islander crewmen funneled the passengers along the starboard rail toward the bow. Block and tackled lattices of heavy cables supported the steel masts and the jib and boom on the bowsprit, providing the crew with ladders to reach the high cross members. Dented sheet steel awnings along the yardarm shielded the sails. These same crude battered roofs protected the ship's wheel and the fore and aft companionways. A crane, now idle, had been set up amidships to shift the boxes from a cluster of waiting rowboats to a large open booby hatch. As J.B. walked past, he peered down into the stinking chaos of the hold. Its living, muti cargo was scared silently shitless. From the bits of conversation J.B. had overheard on the pier, he had learned that the Predark frigate had been built as a naval cadet training vessel, designed to navigate near coastal waters and run up into the deeper river mouths. A recent addition was the battery of black powder cannons on wheeled carriages, each braced with multiple cables strung through sets of block and tackle. Beside the cannons were crates of stacked 9-pound lead balls and canvas bags of grape shot. The Islander gauntlet ended at the foremast. Under a wide metal awning supported by pipe struts was the forward companionway, a windowless iron box leading to the lower deck. Ahead of JB, passengers filed one at a time through the door and down the steep stairs. The slanted roof of the companionway was rimmed with sharp spikes, and each spike was driven through the neck hole and out the top of a stripped, bleached skull. Though the skulls were of different sizes, the features were similar. All had an oval, almost human shape, enormous front-facing eye sockets, and elongated craniums. In place of nose and mouth was a small parrot-like beak lined with tiny serrated teeth. It was a mixture of avian and humanoid characteristics that JB had never seen before. Trophies of previous voyages, he reckoned. JB descended the stairs to the ship's galley. The walls were riveted sheet metal, the ceilings low. There were rows of small circular portholes on either side of the room, but most of the illumination came from the soft glow of oil lamps, which smoke-stained the walls and ceiling. Looking at the built-in benches and tables, JB realized there wasn't enough seating for the 100 or so passengers and maybe 20 crew. They were going to have to be fed in 3 or 4 shifts. Though he was hungry, having waited on the pier since daybreak with nothing to eat but a few strips of venison jerky, the reek of scorched cooking oil and fried fish tied his guts in a knot. He followed the man in front of him between the stationary tables, through the bulkhead door, into the forecastle. The bow of the ship was jammed with tiers of bunks and sweltering from all the passengers packed inside. Some smoked cigars and pipes, some passed around blue antifreeze jugs filled with joy juice. There was little air to breathe and no ventilation. The sleeping compartment was lit by oil lamps that hung on short chains bolted to the ceiling. Though not a tall man, JB could easily reach up and touch the I-beams overhead.
Excuse me.
He pushed his way deeper into the room. There was a lot of jostling going on. Having spent most of his adult life trading bullets and blade thrusts with similar adversaries, JB knew his fellow passengers were wargaming, coldly measuring and marking each other for slaughter. Survival in Deathlands was usually a matter of anticipation, of knowing in advance what someone else was likely to do, and getting off the first, well-aimed shot. It was too early for the long knives to come out, but come out they would. Many in the room would not live to see the end of the voyage. Fewer open palms meant bigger shares when it came time to divide the spoils of war. While searching for a bed, JB passed very close to Christy and Mildred. He didn't acknowledge them, and they didn't acknowledge him. After the double killing on the pier, the other passengers were giving the two women plenty of personal space. Somewhere in the milling throng, Ryan, Doc, and Jack were laying low. JB found an empty berth on the bottom of one of the 3 bunk tiers. Hunkering down, he saw that the pallet lay right on the deck, a human-shaped depression in its compacted straw stuffing. There was just 2.5 feet of space between the floor and the underside of the bunk above. Like everyone else, he chalked his token number on the iron frame. There was no locker to stow personal gear or weapons, which meant taking it all to bed with him, making the bunk space even smaller. He crawled in to check it out. With his head resting on the hard straw, he smelled the cargo hold directly below, the smell of a human zoo, of despair, of filth and misery, festering in heat and humidity. He had slept in worse accommodations. As JB crawled back out, he noticed another passenger, maybe 20 feet away, staring at him intently. The man appeared to have large, hairy ears set way too high on either side of a steeply pointed head. The bodies passing in front of the suspended oil lamps dimmed and strobed the available light and made it difficult to see. Carefully thumbing his steel-rimmed glasses back up the sweat-slicked bridge of his nose, JB squinted. The man was wearing a hooded cloak with attached ears. Even in the low light, the material glittered with thousands of tiny specks. JB recognized it at once. It was the excised skin of a scaly. A skin scraped free of underlying fat, sun-dried, then worked by hand until it was glove-leather supple. Thin, light, breathable. There was a lot of shrinkage in the curing process, though. It took a mighty big scaly to make a man-sized cloak like that. A 500-pounder, maybe. A bearded face protruded from the pointy hood, lips curled, half-smiling. He leaned on a big-bore double-barreled percussion rifle, what in pre-dark times would have been called an elephant gun. It was the kind of weapon Muti hunters used to blast through foot-thick mud walls of huts, ambushing and killing parents so their offspring could be more easily carted off. JB stared back until the man broke eye contact, turned and vanished into the crowd. If the man had recognized him or suspected something, he was keeping it to himself, at least for the time being. He either didn't know for sure, or he had some other agenda. The only thing certain was that discovery by this collection of cold hearts in these cramped quarters would get the companions torn limb from limb, pronto.
Hey, we're setting off!
Passengers surged for the bulkhead door. As he allowed himself to be pushed out of the room, JB caught momentary sight of Ryan. The one-eyed man looked grim, determined, dangerous. JB moved with the crowd up the companionway to the main deck. Most of the crew was already aloft, scampering up the webs of cables along yardarms, unfurling sails. Captain Aang stood behind the ship's wheel, bare feet spread wide. As the sails filled and the ship started to tack back and forth toward the breakers, the great rock, and the wall of fog outside the bay entrance, JB watched the passengers' arrogant bluster evaporate. They were not sailors. They were leaving Terra Firma for an alien, even more hostile environment. If travel in Deathlands was perilous, travel over the sea was 100 times worse, fraught with new hazards, the most pleasant of which was drowning. Halfway down the starboard rail, JB saw Doc conversing with a tall, top-knotted black man and a shorter guy with cracked and peeling face paint who looked like a carny clown coming off a jolt binge. He didn't let his eyes linger for long. Mildred and Christy were on the far side of the deck, standing back to back. As he scanned the rest of the crowd for Jack and Ryan, once again he locked gazes with the man with the skin hood. The man smiled at him. Then he very deliberately looked away from him to Doc, then to Mildred and Christy. When he turned back to JB, he nodded, his hand on the pommel of a sheathed dagger.
Oh, shit.
JB measured the distance, estimated the shot spread left to right, and decided against trying to take him out then and there. At a range of 75 feet, a high brass buckshot round was not a precision-guided munition. No doubt about it, though. Skinhood knew who they were. Yet he hadn't raised the alarm, and didn't appear interested in doing so, which meant he was after something else. Because of that, and because he seemed to be working by himself, JB let things ride for the moment. He moved to the stern of the ship, standing beside one of two iron racks of 55-gallon barrels painted red and securely strapped down. The white ship slid around the Morro Bay Rock into the open Pacific Ocean. As it cleared the California coastline, it was hit by a strong side wind from the north. The sails snapped full, and the vessel heeled over hard to port. The ship righted itself, accelerating through the whitecaps toward the wall of fog. In less than a minute, they were swallowed up by it. Visibility dropped to less than 100 feet. It was wet, cold, and difficult to breathe with all the moisture vapor in the air. The farther due west they sailed, the darker and wetter it got. A gently falling mist became a steady shower. To escape it, many passengers retreated below decks. JB screwed down his fedora and stood his ground, angling his head to keep water drops off his glasses. It took about 15 minutes to break through the far side of the fog bank. On the horizon, dead ahead and to the north, darkness had fallen in the middle of the day. Black sky, black, boiling sea. Captain Aang steered south, where shafts of light speared through a dismal gray cloud ceiling. With the wind squarely behind them, the ship picked up speed, knifing through the swells, slamming the wave troughs. One by one, the other passengers sought the relative safety and protection of the lower deck. Christy and Mildred disappeared down the narrow companionway, followed shortly by Doc. Ryan and Jack waited a decent interval before separately heading for the forward stairs. As the sea state deteriorated, JB watched the captain strap his legs to the helm platform. This to keep from being thrown if the wheel gave a sudden kick when heavy waves pounded the rudder. Every sail filled, Aang was trying to outrun the danger. As the ship porpoised, waves of foam surged over the bowsprit and flooded the deck knee-high. JB was one of the last of the non-crewmen topside. Not because he liked the weather or the company. He was in a pissing contest with a man with a skin hood, who had also refused to take cover. Staggering along the port rail into the wind, the meaty hunter joined him on the stern.
Chemstorm's coming up fast. A great big one. You ain't scared, are you?
Who the hell are you and what do you want?
Red Blastics. We was gonna be pals.
Just spit it out.
You and one eye quarter and the other's got something good going.
Where do you know me from?
I don't know you from swampy shit. Saw you and your crew take apart some Sekhmen one time, though. Impressed me. Heard the stories about you since. You know, the kind of talk that spread around the Gaudis. Not that I believed even half of it.
What do you want?
I want me a piece of whatever it is you're after. Only I want my piece up front.
What's to say you won't tell after we pay you off?
I don't know. You might want to pay me big, though.
Miles off the stern, chain lightning flashed. The smell of ozone rode the wind. They were losing ground fast. An armada of black clouds bore down on them. The captain picked up a conical megaphone.
All in the sails! We're taking cover! There's methane hail ahead!
The islanders raced to obey, despite the wind and the danger. In a matter of minutes, the job was done. The white ship bobbed, yawing and rolling between the immense seas. The last seaman through the hatch was the captain. Still facing off, JB and the Muni Hunter didn't budge from the stern. As the chem storm swept toward them, JB saw an advancing, shifting, miles-wide blue curtain, the color of robin's eggs, falling from the sky. Beneath the edge of the blue curtain, the surface of the sea steamed and boiled, stippled by millions upon millions of impacts.
Methane hail!
Pissing contest forgotten, JB bolted for the aft companionway.
Shit!
What's wrong?
They locked it from the inside!
Fuck!
The man immediately turned and dashed away. JB looked to where he was going. On the bow, a light winked on and off as the forward companionway hatch banged open and shut. JB raced after the meaty hunter. Behind him, a curtain of inch-diameter blue ice balls hit the stern. The ricocheting hail flew every which way, bouncing 20, 30 feet in the air, zipping over JB's head, skittering across the deck in front of him. He reached the awning over the companionway a second after the man, and before he could get through the open hatch. JB caught hold of the pointy hood and used it to jerk him backward off balance, then sidekicked hard behind his weight-bearing knee. They crumpled, and the man crashed to his back. The Muni Hunter jumped up at once, his purple-rimmed eyes wide with terror, his breath fogging in the sudden intense cold. He grabbed for his dagger. JB swept aside the thrust, wrist on wrist, then head-butted his adversary on the chin. The solid blow wobbled the man, and he dropped the dagger. JB planted his feet and snap-kicked at a center-chest bullseye, booting his opponent out from under the awning. The force of the kick sent Skinhood sprawling, sliding across the icy deck. He regained his feet just as the edge of the blue curtain reached him. The torrent of hail pounded him face first into the deck, and in another second, buried him alive.
Gamble big, lose big.
Dr. Antoine Kirby was already awake as dawn approached. He was watching as Doc Tanner woke up. Doc rolled out of bed, stretched, and brushed the bits of straw from the lapels of his black frock coat. When Tanner moved toward the bulkhead in the galley, Kirby eased out of the middle bunk to follow. In the bed above his, Colonel Graydon Bell was sleeping belly up. White grease paint had rubbed off under the coarsely woven cover of the pallet. His bristling cheeks, his brow, even his ears were dappled with bright red pinpoints. His lean jaws were grinding, eyelids fluttering, a steady flow of tears streaming into his receding hairline. As on every night when Graydon went to bed sober, he was dreaming about dead wives and dead children. Kirby shouldered his M16 and headed for the galley. He staggered as he hurried after the lanky man with the ebony walking stick. Kirby hadn't gotten his sea legs yet. Having found Doc Tanner at last, over such a distance of time and space, against astronomical odds, Kirby and Bell couldn't bear to let him out of their sight, and in fact were keeping tabs on him in four-hour shifts. If the ancient academic fell overboard and drowned, if some ex-sec man suddenly took it into his head to shoot him in the back, all was lost forever. In the final months of the 20th century, the physicist and the mathematician had devised a second chance for their world. It was a last chance. There would be no subsequent zipping back and forth in time, working the problem on a trial-and-error basis until they finally got things right. Each zip created an infinitesimal snag in present reality. When overlaid, the zips stretched the original snag into a hole, then a rip. The fabric of existence was far more delicate than anyone ever imagined. The ship's crew were the only takers for the breakfast of mixed fried small fish, squid, anchovies, herring, and sardines. It was all dropped whole by the bucketful into a wide cauldron of boiling oil. After a minute or two, the floating golden-brown clumps and clots were sieved out with a ladle and dumped in great mounds onto long enameled trays. A one-course buffet. Seated islanders hunkered over the tabletops, guarding their plates, eating barehanded, warm grease running down their forearms. The sight and the smell crushed what little appetite Kirby had. He walked to on deck. He stood for a moment, face into the wind, sucking down the cool, fresh air. To the northeast, turquoise sky was shot through with black wisps, the remnants of the chemstorm they had endured. The orange disk of the sun was just breaking the horizon, above a thin, jagged ribbon of land. There was no way to tell how far they had come overnight. Much of it had been spent without sails, bobbing in heavy waves. The sea all around was dark blue with a 2-foot chop, scattered whitecaps, and a blustery wind running from behind. The swell had fallen off to next to nothing. He and Tanner weren't the only passengers on deck, but they were among the few standing upright. Most of the others knelt in front of the scuppers, heads in hands, faces corpse white, beards matted with dried vomit. Rainfall and 60-degree seawater had melted the blue hail and washed away its residue. Ahead of him, Doc Tanner advanced to the bowsprit. Doc looked to be in his 60s, yet he was actually in his 30s. His forced jumps in time had produced intense submolecular stress. That Doc Tanner was not stark raving mad was testament to the resilience of the human spirit. Though Dr. Antoine Kirby had arrived in the hellscape via cryotank, he faced the same stressors as the skinny Victorian, with one difference. Doc was a blameless victim of circumstance. Kirby had helped facilitate the end of civilization. He entered cryosleep as an upper-middle-class intellectual, a button-down closet full of tailored Italian suits, Lexus-driving, happily single, timeshare condo in Maui kind of white coat. A century as an ice block and 4 years fruitlessly roaming Deathlands had changed him beyond recognition. Since his football days, Kirby had consciously repressed his own propensity for violence. He was a big, powerful, physically gifted man who hated aggression. He hated it because it was the easy way out, because it was mindless and irrational, because it contributed nothing to human understanding or betterment. The National Football League, which would have gleefully drafted him in the first round, sold diversion, sublimation, and manipulation. That was something he wanted no part of. In his view, a life without a search for truth was a waste. Thanks to cryogenics, the cerebral Dr. Kirby found himself thrust into a shattered and lawless world. He was suddenly forced to fight, and not just a dozen times a year on weekends, but almost daily, and not to win a game. In the process of some of these battles, he had taken human lives, sometimes with his bare hands. To survive and further the vital mission, he had to unleash the demon within. A case in point. Kirby and Bell hadn't found the brood of skagworms they now carried. They had shared a cookfire with a pair of mutie hunters who'd found them, men they had buried the next morning in shallow graves, hacked into the desert hardpan. The mutie millipedes gave them cover, identities, a way to get close to their quarry without raising suspicion, or the suspicion of his companions. Dr. Theophilus Tanner was a classically educated man, which meant he was trained in science, history, logic, literature, mythology, and dead languages. He had suffered terrible, unthinkable losses, yet stubbornly held on to life. Kirby and Bell knew they couldn't force a man like Tanner into anything, and if they tried, their mission would fail, half completed. The action they required of him had to be performed of his own free will. There was no way around that fact. Accordingly, they had to work with care and subtlety to convince him that it was the right and only thing to do. Before they could hope to do that, before they could reveal who they were and what the goal was, they had to gain his trust. They had already begun to lay the foundation. It had come as a pleasant surprise to Doc Tanner that he and his new acquaintances had experiences in common, In their conversation the previous day, it turned out that the Mutie Hunters had wandered the same territories, knew firsthand many of the Vills, the Baronies, the Hazards Doc and the Companions had faced. Tanner thought it was a coincidence. The small world syndrome. It was not. Kirby and Bell had been on the trail of the Companions from the moment they were reanimated. They had picked up the scent by following tall tales, gossip, and rumors from gaudy to gaudy, campfire to campfire. Then they had started tracking the carnage Tanner and the others left behind. It wasn't just the size or wildness of the country that made the task so challenging. The Companions had access to the pre-dark network of Matran's gateways, housed in nuke-safe subterranean redoubts. Using this still-operational automated technology, they could jump from coast to coast in a matter of nanoseconds. Though Kirby and Bell used the Matran's gateways too, arriving on site even a day late meant the trail was already cold. Just when it had begun to seem like they were never going to close the gap, they got their lucky break. They would act soon, but not now. There were still too many people around.